Welcome to Moments with Marianne. I'm so delighted we're spending this time here today. We have a very inspiring show coming right up with two very special guests. Our first guest today is Amy Herrig, and she's here to share with us her new book, No More Dodging Bullets, a memoir about faith, love, lessons, and growth. Now, Amy is a mother, wife, business owner, and longtime Texan. She currently resides in Dallas with her family, but also enjoys spending time in remote Alaska, helping run the family business there. She loves spending time in the outdoors, hiking, fishing, and is a self-proclaimed foodie, who also enjoys cooking with her family and hosting dinner parties for friends. Now, Amy's story is an example that faith and perseverance can lead to overcoming obstacles and that people can learn from their mistakes and use them to experience growth and self-improvement. So let's welcome to the show, Amy Herrig.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You know, what an honor it is to have you here and to talk about your memoir. My goodness, this, I couldn't believe what was going on when I was reading this book.
Oh, it's a lot. Yes. Yes. It's been a life-changing few years, but ultimately in a really good way.
Well, I think everyone has their own personal journey. Yours has hit some really high points and different points. And so let's talk about like your teenage years. You know, what were those like for you?
Well, initially, you know, my childhood and going into my teenage years was wonderful. And then my world kind of crumbled apart when I was a senior in high school and my parents divorced, and I did not handle it very well. And it was a sort of perfect storm situation where I had a boyfriend that was bad news and led to an abusive relationship and a lot of drugs and ultimately a heroin addiction, which, you know, is obviously very serious. And I was, you know, very lucky to make it through all that. But it was a very tumultuous couple of years of my life, without a doubt.
Was there a point during that time? I know when there's so much going on, there's so much heartache because parents splitting up, it can seem like you're just kind of going through the motions every day.
Yes, I think, you know, as an adult looking back on it, I just didn't know, I didn't have the tools at the time, not because my parents, I mean, they were wonderful parents, but, you know, they were going through their own thing, and I didn't know how to label my feelings and to say I'm angry or I'm hurt. And it was at a very transitional time in life as well. You know, I'm a senior getting ready to graduate and go to college, and suddenly my foundation of my world, we were a very close family, we still are, but were, and was ripped out, you know, from under me. And I just didn't know how to cope with that. So I turned to a lot of unhealthy behaviors.
So, I mean, gosh, a heroin addiction, that's a really heavy one. How did you eventually break that?
Well, I was spared by the grace of God. What we fondly, and I say that jokingly, sort of in my family call the bad news boyfriend. He was arrested for selling drugs and yanked out of my life, which was obviously very much a blessing. And my family, who were very supportive and loving, welcomed me back with open arms and nurtured me back to health and helped me through recovery. And I was just really grateful at 20 years old to know that I could have died. A lot of people die from that, and that I was being given a fresh start. Luckily, I could do that. Not everyone has that, and the support that I had. And so that was something that was very important and helpful in my recovery.
Well, congratulations to you. My goodness. That's, you know, I think
Thank
it's a
you.
Very, yeah, I mean, it's a very empowering and, you know, just a courageous story in many ways, because a lot of people are, you know, they don't have the life skills. And they're turning to different things to help them cope with really bad heartache, you know? And so when you look at overcoming a heroin addiction, oh my goodness, that's a huge thing.
Yes, it is. It is. And, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not something everyone overcomes. And, you know, I don't think that I'm better than anyone who does or doesn't. I just had a different path to take, and I think God had a different path for me, and I had a lot of people in my life rooting for me and helping me, and that's sadly what a lot of people don't have when they're going through an addiction or they lost their way in life.
Well,
but you still have to do the work yourself also, mm-hmm. So it's a combination.
Yeah, it's not like a little fairy comes in, hits you on the head and you're good. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of work.
It is. It is. And I think, you know, the longer something like that goes on, the harder the work is to overcome it. I was lucky that my addiction was only about 2 years. I mean, that's a long time, but it's not as long. I just was so lucky that I was saved and spared in a shorter time. And my boyfriend was taken out of my life. And that was the catalyst for me being able to make those changes and do some things differently.
Yeah. Without a doubt. Yeah. Kind of removing as you're talking, the catalyst that's kind of driving all that behavior.
Yes. Yes. And then dealing with my feelings and my emotions and all the things that I buried all that time. It was really important for me to pretty quickly understand that there was some things I needed to deal with that I had not focused on. And that's a hard part about recovery as well. There's stopping the substance and the addiction, but then there's dealing with all of these emotions that have been buried and stuffed for a long time. And I think that's the part in recovery that a lot of people hit a wall in, because that's a completely different step and sometimes harder, because quitting something, okay, I'm quitting, I'm not going to do that anymore, I've stopped, but now I have to deal with what made me do that, or not what made me, but kind of the issues that I was having that allowed me to play Russian roulette with my life, basically. And mm-hmm. So it's a process for sure.
Well, I think a lot of times people get really afraid of feeling those emotions. And so the thought of maybe stopping an addiction could be a little bit, you know, more difficult, because they're like, gosh, you know, then I'm going to feel everything. And I don't know if I want to feel anything.
Absolutely. I believe that is really the crux of addiction. I mean, I understand addiction can be hereditary and it's, you know, a disease without a doubt, but I think a big component of addiction is yes. What is it I'm running from? What is it I'm burying? Why am I wanting to numb out? Because if you get to a place where you're not wanting to do that, the addiction can sort of take care of itself, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, your family and you went back and forth from Texas to Alaska in your story. Why don't you share with our listeners a little bit of what that was like?
Sure. So Alaska is just this amazing, wonderful place that I think everybody should see in their lifetime, without a doubt. There's nowhere like it in the world. I've been blessed to go many places in the world, and that's where I always want to be over anywhere else. My father, always being an entrepreneur, started fishing lodges, a fishing lodge, and then we grew into multiple fishing lodges, but he started a fishing lodge in the mid-90s up there. And shortly after I'd gone through this drug addiction and my recovery, I had the opportunity to go up there and see it. And it was absolutely life-changing. I don't think there's any greater medicine in the world than Mother Nature and being connected with outdoors and just really the whole beauty of our earth and everything that God's created. And so that was a wonderful thing for me to be able to go there, particularly at that time in my life. And it was just eye-opening to a whole new world, and really inspired me to want to be part of nature and those intrinsic things in life, and not it reaffirmed, you know, my positive growth instead of all the crazy negative things I'd been doing.
So I know that you end up getting into business with your father. What was that like? How did that start?
It started after I'd had my children, my twins. They were about a year old, and it was time for me in my mind to get back into the world. I had finished college a few years before, and I had been working on going back to school. And I put that on hold when I had my babies. And then it was time for me to either go back to school or figure out something to do with my career. And he approached me at that time about coming to work with him. I'm an only child. And he was kind of at a crossroads of what would happen to all of the businesses long term. And he felt like he had been doing it for a really long time, managing all these businesses, and had sort of lost a little bit of perspective. And it's, you know, it's always good to have someone fresh come in, new blood. And I think I'd always maybe thought in the back of my mind that I would work with him one day, being that I am the only child. But so we agreed, and it was a perfect fit, because working with my family, it was understood that I'm a mom first and foremost, and it allowed me a lot of flexibility to still be a very hands-on mom and be with my kids and their school events and things of that nature. But I did immerse myself, as my dad predicted I would, very much into the business and took on even more than I thought I would. But we work together really, really well. And so that's always been a wonderful thing.
So I know everything changed when you turned 39, and I'd love for you to share with our listeners what happened.
So yes, our world turned upside down, and it was due to a product we were selling. And I can say now, after the last 5 years, after 5-6 years, I guess, have transpired, that a big motivation for some of the business practices we were engaged in and selling of certain products was this idea that we were going to make tons of money and money would define our success. And I would not have to worry about the shame I had carried from my past. For many years, I didn't discuss my heroin addiction or my recovery with people unless they were like my innermost circle. And I would shy away from conversations often when people were talking about college years and what they were doing in their late teens and early 20 years, because I knew what I was doing during those years. And I didn't have the confidence and, I guess, inner self-worth to look at that as a positive, and that I had overcome this awful thing and worked through it and had recovered. I looked at it as embarrassing and shameful, and what would people think about me if they really knew? And so I took all that shame and regret and guilt and turned it into this idea that I'll make all this money and I'll be so successful. And we live in this prominent area of Dallas and people will be so impressed by that. And I'll just keep shoving my past, you know, under the rug, and none of that will matter. And it unfortunately led to me making some decisions that were not morally correct. They weren't illegal, and they weren't what we ultimately were accused of doing, but they definitely weren't morally correct. And yeah, we were slapped with a huge civil lawsuit by the federal government, where they raided all of our businesses, my home. They seized all of our property, every penny we had, and then they followed it up a year later with a 17-count federal indictment. And so, yeah, life turned upside down.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I don't think most people realize that when this kind of process happens, I mean, when they take all of your money and seize all of your assets, it's like, how do you then represent yourself? You know, how do you get an attorney that will take care of you when you have nothing?
Yeah, it's really scary that that can happen in our world. And I was, I think, like many people, like you said, they don't realize that I was very naive to it. And I'm even embarrassed to say that I probably thought before this happened to me that if the government came in and did that to somebody, they surely had done something wrong to deserve it. You know, I mean, and I think people either think that doesn't happen, they don't understand it happens, or if it does, what did you do to cause this to happen? And yeah, they don't have to give you any warning. They don't have to give you a cease and desist letter. They don't have to tell you they're investigating you. They can just come in and present an order to the judge and do all of this.
So how was it like? Because, I mean, here you're running a business, you have employees. I mean, you guys are, you know, you've got mortgages and stuff. How was it like during that time after the raid?
Scary, very uncertain. We were actually in Alaska, my father and my husband and I, getting things set up for the beginning of the season there, because it was early June. My kids were at home with my godmother who helped take care of them. They were going to fly up a couple days later. So I wasn't even at home when they showed up and with guns drawn and the whole thing and raided my house. So the worst part of that day was knowing my kids were there and I wasn't there and I didn't even really understand what was going on. And then we couldn't get a hold of any of our employees because they had them all some handcuffed. I mean, they certainly weren't letting them answer the phones. I got a call from an employee who wasn't at work but drove by and understood what was happening. And so he had called, and that's how we were notified that all of our businesses were being raided. We had other assets that were seized earlier in the day. And I mean, the phone calls just kept trickling in all day. And there we are in beautiful, but yet very isolated Alaska, feeling completely helpless. And yes, as the months went by after that, I mean, it was touch and go for 5 years. It was touch and go. We never got anything released during that entire time. And so really, people ask, how did you make it through it? And once again, you know, by the grace of God, we were able to continue operating our businesses. They put liens on all the properties, but didn't actually seize them. And so we were able to regroup and continue operating. And it was very much a one day at a time situation. It taught me a lot about patience and just, you know, having a lot of faith.
Oh, without a doubt. And even things like, you know, the corporate attorney that you guys had, I mean, you had to have a separate attorney and people don't think about these kind of things.
Right. By the time it was all said and done, we had six attorneys and they were all very much needed. And what the saddest part to me is that how many, like you said at the beginning of this part of the conversation, how many people can't do that when you have everything seized and then you're indicted. A lot of times when you're indicted, you get held in custody until you go to trial or make a plea deal. And how do you defend yourself? And we were just so fortunate to be able to do so. It's sad that our system works that way, where a lot of people would not be able to.
So how was that process like, you know, staying out of jail and just, you know, I'm doing everything you can to just stay out of the whole prison process?
Yeah, it was exhausting. It was stressful. We were, when the indictments came out, we were detained. They of course moved to detain us and keep us in prison until, or jail, the holding facility, until trial or the case was resolved. And we had to have a hearing to say why we shouldn't be detained. And so luckily we prevailed on that. But yeah, it was really stressful because, it just went on and on and on. We were supposed to have, I can't even remember the dates now, and it doesn't matter specifically for right now, but our trial date got extended like three times. So it was this 4-year process of just a lot of unknowing, a lot of uncertainty, a constant just living under a dark cloud. I mean, this encompassed half of my marriage, a third of my children's lives. I think at some point it weirdly just became our norm. Not a good norm, but it was just our norm. We're human beings are adaptable if we allow ourselves to be. And I think at a certain point it just kind of became, this is what we're living with until something changes.
Yeah. I mean, when I was reading your book, one of the things I was just astounded by is, you know, it's like the government was playing hardball with you guys and you couldn't get your property back. And all, it's like all of a sudden, you know, homeless and no money and businesses are gone. It's like, how do people move forward, you know?
Yes. And that was, you know, not only were we facing all of these charges where we could have ended up spending life in prison, but even if we didn't spend life in prison, if we were convicted of the majority of the charges, we would be penniless. And, you know, once you have a felony on your record, it's really difficult to get employed. That's another flaw in our system. So yeah, there was just this constant, what is the future? Is there a future? And that's a really strange way to live.
Yeah, it must have just been brutal. You know, and how was it? I mean, you talk about your family and the length of time that this happened. How was it for your family? It must have been just extremely stressful.
It was, I think, It was, without a doubt. My husband is so wonderful. It was all consuming of our marriage. I was 110% into working with the attorneys on the case and researching things and going through discovery with them. It was, you know, my life and my father's life, but I had lived it. I knew all the information and I knew what happened and what didn't happen. And so it was just all consuming. And for my children, you know, I think kids are resilient. When every time a new phase would happen, you know, first there was the civil forfeiture, and then a year later there were the indictments, and then there was the trial about 3 years later. You know, there was always a big media splash, and I know that that would be hard for them because they never knew who might hear what or what they might say to them. But they have been such troopers through it. They've been so strong, and I think ultimately it has formed them into more mature human beings. It's motivated them to set certain life goals. My daughter wants to be an attorney. She's already done several summer programs at different universities in high school to work towards this goal. And so I think it's opened their eyes to the way our government works, the way our world really works, and what can happen to people, and that not everyone is as fortunate as we are to be able to fight for their rights.
Well, and really navigate through all that, because I know in your book you talk about, you know, it was just like a hot mess. I mean, the prosecutors wouldn't let you self-surrender, so you guys are trying to do that to show good faith and to you know, avoid having that happen in public. But then also, you know, just the entire process of, you know, thinking, gosh, you know, I might be going to prison for the rest of my life because of the charges they had stacked, you know.
Yes, it's sort of like being diagnosed with a life-threatening disease and knowing that you have limited time, but you may overcome it, except you're not going to die. You're going to still be alive, but you're going to be watching your life from behind bars with, you know, letters and phone calls. And so you're living every day like this might be my last, but it may not. And I'm going to make every moment count. But what if I still prevail? And it's just this constant head game of what if, what if, what if.
Yeah, without a doubt. I know you mentioned in your book how you believe there's a reason for everything. And hindsight's always, you know, we're always a little wiser with hindsight. But looking back, you know, what do you think that all that was about?
Without a doubt, it was for me to become a better and stronger person. And it was without a doubt for me to tap into my faith, really get closer with God, really understand the world around me. I did grow up with a very privileged upbringing, not just monetary, but plenty of love and attention. And I would always say I knew that not everyone had that, but I didn't really, really know it. And I didn't really probably understand how hard my parents had worked to earn everything they had. It was just kind of given to me. That doesn't mean I didn't work hard and I didn't, you know, go to work with my dad and do everything I could to make the companies more successful. And, you know, I put in my time, but I don't think I really had a true appreciation for life and all the blessings I had and all the people that didn't have those things and what I could actually do with my blessings and good fortune to help others.
How much do you feel that faith played a part in your journey?
Huge part. A huge, huge part. I don't think I've ever been a faithless person. I've never doubted God's existence. I wasn't raised in organized religion. My parents were hippies, and that just didn't really go along with their lifestyle or philosophy. But we always talked about God. They were both raised very religious. I always considered myself a Christian. There was never a doubt about any of that, but I don't think I really fully understood what faith really, really meant. And when I was sort of stripped down to my core and faced with losing really everything, there was really nothing else I had to hold on to except faith and, you know, my close family and circle of friends and a lot of love. But yeah, it became, you know, my praying and my relationship with God became stronger, and it became a refuge, and it became where my most cherished moments of the day were when I was just quiet in my dark room and praying with God and understanding that I didn't have to have shame and guilt. I could let go of that. It was unproductive to hold on to those feelings. They don't help us progress. We all have things we wish we had done differently. And that, you know, understanding that part of faith is this unconditional love and grace, and that it's there for us. And all we have to do is ask for it. It was life-changing.
Yeah, you've had many life-changing adventures along your journey. And we, you know, we look at just what has happened so far, but then you also had to deal with breast cancer.
Yes. And that was a huge life-changing moment. In the middle of all of the legal mess, I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And it kind of derailed everything. It put the case on hold, which that was a blessing in a way. And it gave me a chance to regroup, and it gave me a chance to realize that I really, really wanted to live. I had been in such a funk over all the legal stuff. I wasn't wanting to necessarily not live, but I wasn't really living either. I was just stuck kind of in this black hole of constant crisis in the dark cloud and wondering what if. And so when I got cancer, well, like I said earlier, the way I was living with the legal stuff, it's like living with maybe a terminal disease. And then I was diagnosed with something that could have very well been a terminal disease. And then I was told at one point they thought maybe it had spread. So I had to go through the whole battery of tests. And of course, breast cancer is scary, but it is treatable often. But once it's spread, it maybe isn't. So I remember the moment very clearly, laying in the CT scan machine and thinking they're looking to see if I have cancer throughout my body. And that would mean that I'm not treatable. I mean, I'm not curable. I'm only treatable. And that means that I could have a fatal disease without a doubt. And it just was like a light bulb went off that no matter what else was happening, I wanted to live and I wanted to make every day count. And I'd had all these chances in life and I'd done all these things, but, you know, God was still pushing me along and he hadn't given up on me. And I was going to really focus on doing things differently and moving ahead in the most positive way I could.
Oh, what a courageous story, because I mean, there's so much that is on your plate. It's easy to see, you know, why your daughter's looking at becoming an attorney, having lived that experience with you, you know, having the family gone through that. I'm sure she's going to be such a great advocate for people who, you know, maybe they're being treated and targeted unfairly.
Yes. And there, that happens more often than we realize. You know, we hear the news or we read the article in the newspaper and we often assume that that's exactly what happened. And one of the hardest things for me was we couldn't really go on the record or speak about our side of things while the legal proceedings were ongoing for obvious reasons. I mean, we had a trial coming up and that's a slippery slope. But, you know, it was really frustrating to know, hey, there's a whole other side of than what's being printed or what's being said on the news that the public didn't know about. And people need people to advocate for them. It's something we're really missing in this country.
Well, and then there's this whole other aspect that goes along with it too, that most people, you know, unless they're in this kind of position, they'd never really consider, but you get judges and in some cases, you know, some DAs are elected by voters. And so they're looking to be tough on crime and get their numbers up. Doesn't necessarily always mean that that is a just thing to do.
Exactly. There's a lot of reasons things happen in our legal system that have nothing to do with justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting perspective. You know, through all this, I mean, we've talked about so much through all this. How have you come to your own sense of self-awareness and how do you feel about yourself today?
Well, I love myself more than I ever have before. And I don't mean that in a narcissistic way, but I mean it in a truly just intrinsic way. I understand and appreciate that I am a human being and I'm a child of God, which means I'm loved unconditionally and I can give that love to others unconditionally and to myself. But it also means I'm flawed and I'm imperfect and we all are and we've all messed up. And that's what makes us humans. And that's part of our journey and growth and our learning experience in this life. And that's why I believe we're here. So I've been able to give myself a lot of grace and forgiveness. It was really hard. That was probably the hardest part of all of this, is to know that it was okay that I'd done things I wished I hadn't. As long as I'm moving forward and trying to do better and, you know, digging deep within, I'm a work in progress, and that's really all we can do in life is understand where we're at in that moment and where we want to go forward and do differently. So I've had a lot of personal growth and self-awareness and acceptance come out of this. And that's the biggest gift of all.
What a huge gift that is. And yeah, it's such an inspiration to people that are going through maybe something similar, or have, you know, maybe they're dealing with some type of addiction. You know, it could be money, it could be drugs, whatever that is. But I think you offer a lot of hope for people that are going, gosh, you know, it's going to be impossible to turn my life around. Then they hear your story.
Well, that's my goal, is that I just hope something I say or I've written or something I do just gives people a little glimmer of positivity. And that, you know, even if we think things seem all but over, there's always tomorrow. There's always hope. There's no guaranteed outcomes. There's no magic answers, and we can't see what's going to happen. That's why it's called faith. But there is hope, and the only way we know what tomorrow might bring is if we keep trying. If we give up, we'll never know.
Isn't that true? Well, and I know that you have a nonprofit that's helping people. Why don't we talk about Hopeful Tuesdays? Why don't you share with us what that's about?
Yeah, so Hopeful Tuesdays started out of this just kind of, this is a very grassroots effort that started out in the break room in our office about a year ago. I bought a homeless gentleman that was around the corner from our office a cheeseburger and visited with him for a little bit one day. I had started interacting with the homeless here and there from time to time, something I would have never done years ago. I was, I'll admit, very judgmental. Like I talked about earlier, didn't really understand that not everybody had the same opportunities in life. And he was just really nice, this guy. And I said, well, why don't you come to our office the next day? And you could even take a shower. We have a shower facility that we don't really use. And we'll, you can have lunch with us and we'll visit some more. And so he did, and that was a Monday. And then the next day, I said, come back with some friends, and that was a Tuesday. And so we started this weekly routine of having some of the homeless neighbors in our community come by and have lunch and take a shower. And it was a handful of people each Tuesday, and then it just continued to grow from there. And Tuesdays then grew into Fridays because we were having so many people come. And now last month we started doing 4 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Fridays. And as it started growing months ago to Tuesdays and Fridays, we came up with the name Hopeful Tuesdays because it started with Tuesdays. And we're just really trying to bring people hope and give them a safe place that they can come, have something to eat, take a shower, have fellowship. And we've now partnered with larger resources that have bigger community outreach programs that can help them eventually get into housing. We've helped some get into rehabs, get their identification back, because a lot of them are missing that. And, so yeah, now we serve about 200 meals a week, and we've renovated an entire area of our office because my employees appreciated having their break room. They appreciate what we're doing too, but we've now renovated an entire area in the back of our office warehouse. And we had our big Thanksgiving, first Hopeful Tuesdays Thanksgiving a couple weeks ago. And it's just been this wonderful, life-changing thing that I'm so grateful to be able to do.
So Amy, where can our listeners connect with you and be part of your community?
Sure. So I have my website, which is amyherrig, H-E-R-R-I-G.com. That tells a little bit more about me and my story and the book. And then I also have the website for Hopeful Tuesdays, which is Hopeful Tuesdays, plural with an S on the end, .org.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with us here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me and letting me share a little more about my story. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Amy. It's been such an honor to spend this time with you and, of course, to talk about your new book, No More Dodging Bullets, and also your nonprofit, Hopeful Tuesdays. Again, if you'd like to connect with Amy, you can at amyherrig.com for more information. Well, on that note, we're going to pause here for a quick break. You've been listening to Moments with Marianne. We'll be right back after these messages.
Internationally recognized and award-winning author Judy Goodman works and teaches outside the box of limited thinking. Working with people from every walk of life, her goal is to empower you to be the best you can be, no matter what the challenge is. Born with the gift of seeing beyond our normal vision, she has an extraordinary gift of working with every challenge. Teaching beyond conventional wisdom, her work is described as life-changing. Visit judygoodman.com. That's judygoodman.com.
There comes a moment when you realize you're somewhere special, when you discover that each beautiful creature that you see has been rescued from a life of absolute horror and brought to this incredibly free place. Here's where their lives were forever changed and where yours will as well. Discover over 500 tigers, bears, and lions at the brand new visitor center at the Wild Animal Sanctuary just outside Denver. For more information, visit wildanimalsanctuary.org. Discover true freedom at the Wild Animal Sanctuary.
There are nearly 2 million Americans living with amputation. Many live right here in San Antonio. Becoming an amputee can be scary, frustrating, isolating, but there's no reason to feel alone. The San Antonio Amputee Foundation is here to help support you and guide you toward resources such as home and car modifications and even prosthetic limbs. For more information or to make a donation, visit saamputee.org. We'll help you live a full, active life, one step at a time. San Antonio Amputee Foundation, healing limbs, hearts, and souls.
If not me, then who? This ethos is driving the Travis Mannion Foundation to empower veterans and families of fallen heroes to develop character in future generations. In 2007, Marine First Lieutenant Travis Mannion was killed in Iraq while saving his wounded teammates. Travis's legacy lives on in the five words he spoke before leaving for his final deployment. If not me, then who? Guided by this mantra, veterans continue their service, developing strong relationships in the community, and thrive in their post-military lives. Visit TravisMannion.org and ensure the character of our nation's heroes lives on in the next generation. If not me, then who?
Welcome back to Moments with Marianne. We're here today with our next special guest, Dr. Herman Williams, and he's here to share with us his new book, Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of. Now, Dr. Herman is the managing director of the BDO Nashville Healthcare Advisory Practice and is a leader in the BDO Institute for Healthcare Excellence and Innovation. He has extensive experience as a senior hospital executive with healthcare expertise that include the management and operations of large and small-scale national clinics and hospitals. His successful leadership has resulted in achieving the highest and safest levels of quality inpatient and outpatient care. So let's welcome to the show, Dr. Herman Williams.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you inviting me on your show.
What an honor it is to have you here and to talk about your book. My goodness, there's parts of it that were really such a tough read. I mean, you take the reader on your personal journey, and what a journey.
Yes, it's written that way intentionally to try and get you to take this ride on how, you know, we all have great plans for our life and we all have great dreams, but the book really talks about how sometimes there are different plans for you.
Yeah, I think there's that famous saying, you know, that we make plans and God laughs, right?
That's right. That's right.
Oh, well, why don't you share your journey with us? I know, you know, you were kind of deciding on doing different things in your life, and you decided that you were going to be a doctor.
Yes. You know, I always wanted to be a doctor, and that was sort of an innocent dream. I think it was a little bit modified by my experience growing up in Los Angeles, California, where it became then, it was a little superficial, and I've had the benefit of being able to reflect now on how superficial it was. But I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. I wanted to come back to the town where I grew up in Los Angeles, and I wanted to be the team doctor for the Los Angeles Lakers. And it's just very simple. And I embarked on really a journey of excellence to put me in a position to be able to at least be considered for that opportunity. And superficial in the sense that I say, you know, in retrospect, it would have been nice just to say, look, I want to be a doctor and wanted to be a successful orthopedic surgeon. But I have this dream of coming back home and being a doctor to the stars. And of course, God had different plans for me.
Well, it's really interesting, you know, just the journey that we take and what ends up happening. And I know you went through a very traumatic, your book talks about that. It's all what your book's about is you went through a very traumatic health crisis.
Yes. I was a healthy person at age 31 without a care in the world. I was actually still playing intramural sports. And probably two of the smartest things I did was one, I joined an anesthesia basketball team. And the second thing is I brought my wife to the game. But one day, Sunday morning, when we were playing a basketball game on April 28th, 1991, I was playing and felt uncomfortable, pulled myself out of the game, and sat next to my wife, who was the scorekeeper. And I say I was lucky to invite her, because if she had not been there, what happened is I had a cardiac arrest on the sideline. And those guys didn't even know. They were just playing. And she screamed at the top of her lungs to all the players that I had gone down and was foaming at the mouth and rapidly turning blue and purple. But I had also been blessed with joining an anesthesia basketball team. And the beauty of that is anesthesiologists are probably the best experts at resuscitation. And those guys jumped on me immediately and started performing CPR. And as we know now, and probably knew then intuitively, but we definitely know now, the sooner you start CPR, the more likelihood that you're able to resuscitate someone. And so having someone yelling immediately and having those guys immediately run, it was probably a matter of 10 or 15 seconds before CPR was initiated. And I think that had a lot to do with the outcome. Of course, I'm here still, so it was successful. But it was a very stressful moment, a traumatic moment on the basketball court that day.
I can only imagine. I mean, my goodness, thank goodness your wife was there and that you were surrounded by these heroes that really came,
yes,
you know, came to your rescue, because I mean, they were doing chest compressions on you for 10 minutes.
Well, and, yeah.
Wow.
So they, first it was 5 minutes, then the EMTs arrived with a defibrillator. And the reason why the book is called Clear is because these guys came in and put the defibrillator on and said, clear. which means everybody get out of the way, because if anybody is touching the body when they shock a person, whoever's touching the body will get shocked also. And it turned out that the first defibrillator they brought did not work. So they had to resume CPR for another 4 or 5 minutes until the fire department got there with a defibrillator. And ultimately, they were able to resuscitate me.
It seems like that was a lesson for a lot of people that day, you know?
Yes.
You know, like double check your equipment and, you know, just, you know, all it was, you know, it was a best and worst case scenarios all at the same time.
Yes. And everybody thinking in their minds, one of the data points that I frequently talk about when I speak about my situation is that they're roughly today, about 85% of people who have a cardiac arrest outside of the hospital even make it back to the hospital. You can imagine doing CPR in the field for 10 minutes, what my odds were of actually, one, being resuscitated, and once I was resuscitated, actually walking out of the hospital to be a productive member of society. So the odds were really against me that day.
Yeah. Well, and it was a good thing you had so many people around you, because for those that maybe have not done chest compressions before, that's exhausting. You know, when you're doing
it, it's very exhausting.
Mm-hmm. So, and to go through that, and then as a person also, a lot of people don't think about it's like how you feel afterwards, because your body's just gone through so much.
Well, I was exhausted and in a tremendous amount of pain, because if you're doing chest compressions right, they tell you if you fracture a rib, that means you did it right. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I didn't have any rib fractures, but it felt like I had been stomped on. So I was in quite a bit of pain and in the hospital for quite a while.
Yeah. So how was it leaving the hospital? Because I know, you know, just being in the hospital, it changed so much for you, really, just overnight.
Well, it did. So first of all, you know, we go back 28 years, and even though the time in the hospital was longer than it is today, because, you know, today you're like in and out, but my entire hospital stay was 28 days. And that was partly because while I was there, a doctor came in and introduced some new technology to me and said, hey, we got this device that we can surgically place into your body. And anytime you have a bad rhythm, this device will shock you and you will never have to rely on 911 again. And so my wife and I thought about that, and that sounded like a reasonable idea. So I agreed to be in the initial clinical trials for the what we now know as the implantable cardioverter defibrillator. And then post-op, I had some complications. I had esophagitis and all kinds of other complications. But the total time that I was in the hospital was 28 days. And because I had a cardiac issue, I could never leave the cardiac unit. So I was literally in a cardiac unit or a bed for 28 days of my life, just sitting there contemplating these incredible dreams that I had, and how I was really, right before the cardiac arrest, I had just submitted my application for the sports medicine fellowship in Los Angeles, California. So I could really, I could literally taste the achievement of my dream, and all of that got swept away with one heartbeat. Yeah. One bad rhythm just changed everything.
Well, we're grateful that you're here. And obviously the defibrillator that they attached to your heart, that worked, you know, but I understand that they probably weren't quite aware of exactly the amount of pain that would be if it went off.
Well, I think they knew the amount of pain. I think it was a little bit of a a vacuum cleaner salesman selling a vacuum cleaner. He wasn't totally honest about how painful it would be, but clearly that device has saved my life numerous times. But I think the real challenge for me, and at that time, again, we got to put ourselves back 28 years ago, we didn't know the amount of medication it would take to control my arrhythmia. And so literally for the next 6 months after I got out of the hospital, while we kept ratcheting the medication up slowly, 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 because you don't want to give too much because of the side effects, I was getting shocked, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a month. And at the end of 6 months, I had literally been shocked over 40 times, which is just not compatible with life, as you might imagine.
Wow.
And for the scientists in your audience, it's about 45 joules of current. So it's really powerful enough to actually shock your heart into a normal rhythm. So it's just like getting defibrillated. Except, of course, when you defibrillate on top of the skin, it takes more energy than if it's coming from within. And by that, let me just explain. Literally, they sewed patches around my heart, and those patches were technically devised so that they could literally detect an arrhythmia by surrounding my heart, and then those patches would trigger an impulse to a device that was outside the skin, just underneath the skin, just above my waistband. And that generator, which was about the size of a mobile phone that we carry now, would literally shock me into a normal rhythm. And it would keep shocking until it was able to do that. So sometimes it took more than one shock. And as you might imagine, it was incredibly painful and agonizing and very depressing experience for that first 6 months with this new technology. But at the same time, it was saving my life. So, you know, trying to reconcile that emotionally was very difficult.
How did you end up getting to a place where you were able to reconcile that? Because I think for a lot of people, that'd be really difficult. I mean, it can be a very scary event. You know, maybe if people aren't as medically aware as you are, going through something like that and then having the shocks happen and going, gosh, you know, that could be a really scary thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, although I was a trained physician at that time, when these kinds of things happen to you, you kind of go to basically your basic instincts. And so all that medical training went out the window. And I think the thing that got me through it, of course, was my belief that God had a different plan for me. And I just could not believe that I would spend all this time. I spent at that point 13 years of my life training to be a physician and subsequently a surgeon. And I just believed that there was something else for me, and I just had to wait it out. And I, of course, I had my moments where I just cried and was very depressed and afraid to leave the house because I thought I'd get shocked if I left the house. And it was a huge emotional turmoil, but again, through my strong faith and through therapy, and probably one of the other most important things is my wife was literally my guardian angel and just guided me through this whole process to get to a point where finally we had found the right medication after numerous times and numerous failures. And right around 7 months, I started being able to conceive of the possibility of living a normal life. And so, you know, in the book, it really says perseverance overcomes and trumps pain. And I just had to persevere. I just knew there was something bigger and better for me.
Yeah, it sounds like your wife really was a rock through the whole situation and just helped with everything.
She really was. I mean, and the thing that we all have to be aware of is when you have a caretaker like that, because there's so many people taking care of their loved ones and friends and taking them to, you know, the doctor for cancer therapy and for all kinds of things. You know, every time you go through something, that caretaker experiences it also. And so, you know, every time I got shocked, she's sitting there watching me getting shocked and yelling and screaming. And so the fact that she could withstand that emotional drain, but still portray to me this face of, you know, relax, Herman, you know, focus on me, just try and relax. You know, I mean, it was just amazing how she was able to help me through that just incredibly difficult time. And so one of the messages I want to leave the listeners with is you got to have somebody to help you if you're experiencing something like this. And it's really important to have a loved one or someone who has that strength to help you through those moments of weakness and moments of doubt. And then a lot of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of prayer.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, you didn't go just for a small heart attack. You went for, yeah, I mean, you had the big one happen, and it's changed your life in really profound ways. You know, I understand you ended up having to make shifts from the medical career as well.
Yeah, so the irony, it's almost like a bad joke, is the device that was actually saving my life, as we now know, is very sensitive to magnetic fields. And that's why people with pacemakers and defibrillators can't go near an MRI because of the strong magnetic field. Well, it turns out that the doctors thought that the Bovie, which all surgeons use to cauterize vessels, when a vessel ruptures, you kind of burn it with a little cautery. But we actually felt that cautery had enough of a magnetic field potentially that it could actually trigger an inappropriate shock during surgery. And so my career in surgery basically ended. But I began to think about the superficial nature of what it was that I wanted to do. And really, Marianne, it was important for me to say what I really want to do is help people. And whatever that vehicle is, I need to figure out what it is. And maybe I thought it was surgery, but it's not. I thought it was being a physician and being a clinician, but it's not. And so I had to seek out and understand the capabilities that I had acquired over the years and figure out, okay, how can I take what I have and basically create a new dream that would encompass helping individuals? And that's really how I think I pulled myself emotionally out of this, as I found in healthcare consulting, and ultimately ended up in hospital operations, that actually I ended up helping more people as a chief medical officer of a national organization that had 18 hospitals in 13 states, and helped oversee over 10,000 doctors in providing quality care to patients, that the dream that God had laid out for me was so much larger than that superficial dream to come back to Los Angeles and being a physician to, you know, an NBA basketball team. But you have to go through that transformation, that self-examination. And for those people who are out there suffering, you have to ask yourself, I know I can do something. what is it truly? What is the most basic thing that I want to achieve and do? And for me, that was help people. And I figured there are a lot of ways I could do that with the skills that I had. And that's how I kind of pulled myself up.
Well, especially because you have a very unique experience about going through this very difficult time and coming out the other side. Yeah. And so I think it provides people a lot of hope. You know, it's getting in these situations, someone, you know, you think you're healthy and you have a medical event that happens and all of a sudden your world is just turned upside down.
Yes. Yes.
I know you share how suffering is relative, is a relative experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love for you to expand on that for our listeners.
Well, so when I tell my story, you know, it's funny. One of my dear friends said to me, he said, "Oh my God, I will never, ever complain about having the flu ever again." And I told him, I said, "Look, pain is relative. If the most painful thing you've experienced is having the flu and, you know, just being sick as a dog, then for you, that is your pain point. For me, you know, the most painful thing I've experienced is, you know, getting shocked 25 times before I got to an emergency room. But I have no idea what it's like to lose a leg in battle or to lose a limb, you know, in a hunting accident. Or so it's all relative. We can't compare, you know, scars and say who's got the biggest scar. And pain is such a personal experience. You know, for something that's painful to me might not be painful for you. And so really, pain is a relative experience and suffering is a relative experience. And I just say that so that people don't feel like, oh, wow, you know, what I'm experiencing is so small. It's not. It can be big relative to what you've experienced. And that just validates it for you. So, you know, for those people who have respiratory conditions who are listening to your show and saying, oh my God, you know, I shouldn't be complaining. Well, that can be pretty debilitating. So I just say that so people don't compare and try and say, well, yours is worse or yours is, you know, better than mine.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you on that because one person's, you know, suffering, you know, there's no way to compare that with what somebody else is going through. It's such a personal journey.
Yeah.
Well, and so when we look at your life today, because you've gone through so much, we're not going to get into everything in your book, Clear. It has a lot of great information and insights on your journey. What are some of the things that really kind of empowered you through this process today?
So I think persevering kind of gives you a level of strength so that if you encounter another situation, you're more likely to believe, oh, I'm going to get through this just like I got through the last one, you know? So it's you know, it's very similar to my medical training. When you see one condition and you treat it successfully, when you encounter that same condition again, you instinctively jump to, okay, I know this worked in the last scenario. Let me start this treatment program right away and get it going. So when you encounter, you know, when I am ill, I am more likely to believe that it's just going to be a temporary situation because of all the illnesses and the hospitalizations I've had. I'm more likely to enter those situations with a sense of relaxation because I've persevered. So that's one of the main things, is just through perseverance, you learn to overcome adversity. My book also talks about things really unrelated to health, but the fact that many people told me I couldn't do things that I thought I wanted to do. And as I began to become more successful and overcome adversity, overcome a challenging medical curriculum, overcoming not getting into med school the first two times I applied, you just gain more confidence as you finally achieve those difficult goals that you set out. And then lastly, I think just having the support of others empowers you to let you know you're not doing this alone. So those are just sort of three areas that I think I wanted to leave the readers with to try and empower them as individuals in their individual situations.
You know, I heard one of your talks where you discussed how, just gratitude was so different for you today as it was, before this happened, and that you reach out to people immediately.
Yes. So, ironically, it took me probably, 24 of those 28 years. In my 24th year after the original cardiac arrest, it turned out that I had made a decision to switch medications really out of convenience. So I'm on a blood thinner that requires you to get your blood tested monthly. And there was some initial research that came out that said that basically aspirin was just as effective as a prescription blood thinner. And I really wanted to believe that because I didn't want to get stuck, every month to measure my blood level. And so I made the decision with my doctor that we would go on aspirin. And long story short, what had happened is while I was on aspirin, it wasn't effective enough, actually. And I formed a clot in my heart and I actually experienced a stroke. And literally, I came to the emergency room with my wife, and I was aphasic. I literally, when I spoke, it was just a bunch of gibberish, and no one could understand what I was saying. And I was like that for 3 days. And I just, my life flashed before me, and I really just contemplated what it would be like not to be able to speak for the rest of my life. And then miraculously, 3 days later, my voice came back. And it was then that I realized probably the most important thing throughout this entire journey of how blessed I was and how I just had missed the whole message is that through this gratitude of being able to withstand these challenges, these health challenges, it was my obligation to turn around and to share that gratitude with others. And so in the book, I came up with a kindness scale. And that was partly because it was funny. I had a close friend of mine who I had talked about compassion and living a compassionate life. And she said, I get it. I don't understand how to be compassionate. I'm just not a compassionate person. And so I said, well, let me come up with a scale that will help people understand what compassion is. And there are four levels in the scale that essentially are levels of kindness, levels of gratitude that range from opening a door. Actually, the most basic function is just smiling at another individual. And then that goes up through actions like opening a door, helping someone put something up in a bin in an airplane, to actually helping someone with a challenging situation. Many times I tell friends of mine, if you're in the hospital, let me call the doctor to communicate, because that sends a different signal to the whole team. All of a sudden, everybody's acting differently because now they know there's a doctor on the other end. So using your strength to help someone else. And then, of course, level four, which is the highest level of gratitude and kindness, is actually giving CPR to another individual, or as an example, giving up an organ, giving up a kidney to someone who needs an organ. And so I now have a mission that everyone that I come in contact with, I try and make better off in some small or large way than they were before they met me. And so literally I purposefully try and enhance someone else's life by telling a joke or opening a door or saying good morning or, you know, just different levels of gratitude.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying it's just interesting how these small things matter so much.
They really do. They really do. You can see an immediate response. If you smile at someone, 9 times out of 10, they're going to smile back. They don't know why they're smiling, but they do. And that could be just enough because we're all dealing with something, you know, we all got a sick parent or challenging financial crisis or stress at work or whatever. And those little things, I think, can make the difference in someone's life.
Well, Herman, we can talk all day in regards to your experience. And you're such an inspiration. I'm so glad we got to spend this time together. Where can our listeners connect with you and be part of your community?
Well, I have a website, clearlivingthelife.com, where people can leave messages. They can purchase the book. The book is also available on Amazon, and it's a book with Barnes and Noble's also. So those are 3 ways that they can reach out to me.
Okay,
and I'm always open to try and help in any way I can.
Well, Herman, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with us here today.
Well, the blessing is all mine, and I appreciate it. It's an honor to be on your show, to be able to share what I've learned, and hopefully I can help one person out there understand their situation a little bit better than before they heard the show.
I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. My goodness, your story has made such a huge impact on me. I can only imagine the impact it leaves on others. Again, if you'd like to connect with Dr. Herman Williams, you can at his website, clearlivingthelife.com. And also make sure to check out his book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all indie retailers. Again, that's Clear, Living the Life You Didn't Dream Of. Well, we're at the end of our time today. I would like to thank everyone for tuning in. You're listening to Moments with Mary Ann. And remember, make every moment count.
In a single moment, your life can change. Moments with Mary Ann is a transformative hour that covers an endless array of topics with the best of the best. Her guests are leaders in their fields, ranging from inspirational authors, top industry leaders, and business and spiritual entrepreneurs. Each guest is gifted and a true visionary, a recognized leader in her own work, and while teaching others to develop, refocus, and grow, Mary Ann will bring the best guest and sometimes a special surprise. Don't miss this. You never know just which moment will change your life forever. Moments with Mary Ann airs every Sunday, Monday, Thursday, and Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern and 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Make sure to tune in and visit MomentsWithMaryAnn.com for more information.